Taking a look today at agriculture, climate change, bioenergy crops in the Great Lakes region. Lots of things we can talk about with our two guests today. I'm Larry Mueller, and my guest with me in the studio today, John Greenler. Great to have you back, John.
Always a pleasure to be here, Larry.
John directs education at the Wisconsin Energy Institute of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And Phil Robertson. Philip is the sustainability lead with Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and directs the long-term ecological research at the Kellogg Biological Station. And Philip, great to have you with us.
Oh, thanks very much, Larry. Delighted to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you here as we talk about using plants as energy. We take a look at climate change, how do we manage agriculture in this time of climate change? What impacts does agriculture have on it all, and how can we mitigate it a little bit? These are some of the things our guys have been working on, and I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments as we move along today. Maybe you're somebody who views bioenergy as a viable alternative to fossil fuels. Maybe you don't think so. What questions do you have about bioenergy, and again, as it relates to climate change? Call in at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to hear from you. And, Phil, maybe you could start out by talking a little bit about the Kellogg Biological Station.
Sure. It's a biological station that is part of Michigan State. It's located in southwest Michigan, and it conducts research in conservation, ecology, and agriculture, and we are particularly interested, and my and other groups here, in researching agricultural ecology. That is to say, thinking about how ecological processes go on inside agricultural systems, mainly row crops such as corn, soybeans, and wheat, which is all three are major crops in the Great Lakes region. And we're very interested in discovering ways to manage them in a more sustainable manner, and especially to provide the fundamental research that can provide agronomists the tools to perhaps use more biological means to manage these crops and lessen their environmental footprint, as opposed to the chemical-intensive means that we currently deploy across most of the Midwest.
Yeah. And John Greenler, I think this kind of research, and Phil's been involved in this, I like the term long-term. I think that's an important part of this.
Definitely. You know, and in the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, we've been really fortunate to be able to take a very similar kind of long-term approach to looking at bioenergy, bioenergy crops, biofuels specifically as well. You know, we're now in year 9, very fortunate to have funding from the Department of Energy, looking into year 10 at this point, possibly, hopefully beyond. But it really takes this kind of a timeline, especially when you're looking at agroecological systems, to be able to do this kind of research. When you're looking at perennial crops, whether you know it be prairie plantings or more woody species, it just takes some years to get these experiments, the plantings established, and really be able to get data that gives us a good indication of how these different types of cropping systems function.
And this whole business about agriculture, I'm wondering, and maybe Phil, you could address this a little bit about its impact on, or potential impact on climate change. This is kind of what it sounds like, a real strong area of interest for you.
It is. So, as everyone recognizes, agriculture uses fossil fuels, and what many people don't recognize is that agriculture also produces greenhouse gases other than CO2 from burning diesel as tractors go across the field and so on. And these other greenhouse gases include methane and nitrous oxide. And if you look at agriculture as a sector, it's responsible for about 14-15% of the total greenhouse gas production globally, which doesn't include land use change. And so if you just look at the amount of greenhouse gases that are produced from agriculture like we practice in the Midwest, we're looking at about the same global impact as the transportation sector. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't sound like a huge amount, but as we know, the climate change is the result of lots of different economic and human activities, and the solutions are going to have to come from addressing these in a portfolio approach. And so understanding how much each sector contributes and then trying to get a handle on how each sector can contribute to mitigation is an important part of tackling this this problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot of work, obviously, on what agriculture can do to sort of mitigate, and that's kind of what you're looking at here, isn't it?
Well, that's right. I mean, there are a number of sources of greenhouse gases in climate change, fuel use, as I mentioned, but that's a surprisingly modest amount. When agriculture is first established on a natural ecosystem, a lot of soil carbon is converted to CO2, and that has contributed to CO2 buildup in the atmosphere, especially prior to fossil fuel use. But there are also big impacts from fertilizer use, both from adding nitrogen to soils and the production of nitrous oxide following that, which is produced by microbes in the soil that use a fertilizer in the same way that crops use a fertilizer, and then also CO2 that's produced when fertilizer is manufactured in a refinery. And understanding these different sources gives us an opportunity to look at the flip side, that is to manage agriculture to mitigate climate change, not only to make agriculture climate neutral, but actually climate negative. And we can do that through three main activities. One of those might be managing fertilizer in a better way. Another might be to build soil carbon. And as we'll get to, a third and huge potential impact is growing cellulosic biofuels to substitute for some of the fossil fuels that we're currently using.
Yeah, and John, there's a lot of research on the cellulosic, the biofuels.
That's correct. You know, what we're talking about today is really a key element, you know, of our research in the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, looking at those agroecological systems. But we're really involved in what we call the whole pipeline, essentially. How do we make sure we're getting biomass so we can convert into fuel sustainable, in a sustainable fashion? But then also, how do we break down that biomass into the constituent molecules? A lot of sugars are contained in that fibrous plant material. And then finally, how do we convert those sugars into fuels? I think we're very familiar with ethanol, but clearly there's a wide range of different types of fuels that we can make from that fibrous or cellulosic plant biomass. Probably in the long run, it's maybe even more important to look at things like diesel and jet fuel. We'll probably have the increased opportunity to replace cars, our internal combustion cars, our gasoline-driven cars, with electric vehicles. But we're not going to be doing that anytime in the near future with our semi-tractor trailers or our commercial planes and related.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we have callers online. By the way, if you'd like to join in with your own questions or comments, thoughts, give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can also post a comment or question on our Facebook page, the Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show, or email us at talk@wpr.org. Let's turn to Austin now in Richmond, Illinois. Austin, thanks a lot for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, first of all, I want to say thank you for having a guest. I'm an alumnus of Michigan State and spent a summer at the Kellogg Biological Station. Great work.
Oh, cool.
But excellent.
Pointedly, I'm curious as to see what his inclination might be on how biofuels might end up going mainstream. You're touching on how it can be related in ag and commercial applications, but how you might transition that into the private market.
Hmm. So that is a big aspect of what the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center is involved in, is how to build the fundamental knowledge that's needed to commercialize biofuels. And there are, the biggest barrier right now, frankly, is economics, and that currently, certainly in the current energy environment, fossil fuel environment, the cost of making a cellulosic biofuel is greater than that of petroleum energy. But that's not going to be the case forever. Certainly, we're hoping not for any more than a few years as new research comes to fruition and we find less expensive ways to convert the cellulosic material into fuel molecules, whether ethanol or isobutanol or some other molecule that can be easily converted to a fuel or to some other bioproduct. So that's one aspect of it. The other is also related to a benefit of biofuels that's different from grain-based biofuels, in particular cellulosic biofuels, and that is the fact that with cellulosic biofuels, we have the opportunity to grow those on lands where we're not currently growing food, so there would be effectively no competition with food crops. And once we learn how to grow these crops or these cellulosic crops on what could be called more marginal lands, then we'll also be in a better position to make them economically viable.
Austin, thank you so much. Did you have a follow-up? I'm sorry.
Okay, go ahead. I think that's good at this point.
Thanks again for that call. Appreciate it very much. Well, if you look over, say the last 10 years, there have been some advances, John.
Definitely. You know, and I think it is, you know, worth pointing out that, you know, we really are seeing in the past year, really, even the beginning of the commercial rollout of kind of the early stages of a cellulosic biofuel industry. You know, here in the Midwest, it's largely at this point focused on taking corn stover, the residue material after the grain is harvested from the plant. We still have the stalks and the leaves, the cob, et cetera, all that very fibrous material, almost in some cases like the cob, it has a very woody quality to it. And we now do have commercial scale plants that are converting that fibrous, you know, corn plant material into ethanol. So we are, you know, we're seeing some significant advances along those lines. And I think that, you know, now we're in a position of beginning to look a little further down the road, down the pike, so to speak, and say, how can we use a greater diversity of different types of plant biomass, you know, as Phil was saying, some of these types of perennial crops that we can grow on marginal lands to produce fuels, but then also what other types of fuels that can we be producing beyond ethanol and also other types of bioproducts. A lot of people don't recognize that when we talk about petroleum, clearly a very significant portion of that is going into liquid fuels, but it's not trivial the amount of petroleum that we put into other types of products. We think about the plastics that are all, you know, so predominant. Mm-hmm. And in our world today, you know, by and by, that material is largely all coming from petroleum. And so there is a significant opportunity to take some of those materials and actually make them from bio-based products, cellulosic-based products even. So the same is true for pharmaceuticals as well. So there's a wide range of different opportunities we're looking at.
Yeah, I think that's an important point because if you look at the value of a barrel of crude, a substantial part of the value actually comes from a minor part of the of that barrel, and a lot of that higher value materials are these bioproducts that John mentioned.
Oh. We have Aaron in Gurnee, Illinois, with a question for you guys. Let's go there. Aaron, hi. Thank you for calling.
I was curious to know about any of the work that's being done with algaes and developing oil from algaes. There's with no modification or very little modification, any diesel engine can run on vegetable oil. Mm-hmm. Used vegetable oils being hauled back by KFC and most of the major food chains to use and power up their trucks making biodiesel. What's going on with algaes and things like that?
Yeah, interesting question. And let's turn to Phil first. Phil?
Well, there is a fair amount of research being done with algae, as the listener mentioned, and not so much within the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, but in other places. And algae has its place. As you mentioned, algae can produce these lipids, these oils that can be, with relatively little modification be turned into a burnable fuel, just like soy can be. That is to say, soybean and soybean oil. One issue with respect to algae is the water requirements, mm-hmm. and so
yeah.
That can be a major barrier to deploying it widely. Where you have lots of water, you tend not to have a whole lot of lights, not as much lights. So the Great Lakes region, for example, and where you have a whole lot of light, which is, of course, what these algae use to power their photosynthesis, such as in the desert, you don't have a lot of water. And so, and recycling water is a challenge because mm-hmm. of the biofouling, the biofilms that develop in these algal systems. But, you know, these are technologies that can probably be engineered, that engineering improvements can probably make viable at some point. And I think algae are probably part of the overall energy portfolio that we'll have at our disposal in the future. But it's not, you know, just like other aspects of our energy mix, there's no single silver bullet. And so we need to address all of these and hopefully have a healthy mixture of different technologies in the future.
Taking a look at agriculture, climate change, bioenergy crops, research at through the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center with John Greenler, directs education at the Wisconsin Energy Institute at UW-Madison. Phil Robertson, sustainability lead with the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and director of long-term ecological research at the Kellogg Biological Station. You can join in with your questions or comments as we move along here. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller, Jill Nadeau, our producer. On-air producer today, Malik Anderson, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 11:45 today, we'll be taking a look at how women can successfully rejoin the workforce. And I hope you can stay with us for that at 11:45. Right now, taking a look at some of the great research that's going on in the area of climate, agriculture, climate change, and bioenergy crops with our two guests, John Greenler and Philip Robertson. Really pleased to have them with us. You may have questions. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Email at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. Mark in Brookfield up next. Mark, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call today. I'd like to ask your guests what they're doing as far as research into industrial hemp as a possibility for your cellulose as your feedstock. I understand, well, I've been reading up on it, and I know that there's close to 80% cellulose in the stock, and that could be, you know, used as your cellulose, and also the oil can be used as a diesel as well. And hemp is low in pests and herbicides. It's very, very good on the soil. In fact, it brings it back, and it actually sequesters carbon as it's growing. So I'm wondering why you guys don't bring this up or aren't looking at it.
Well, let's talk about that. John, do you want to start?
For sure. Yeah, I think it's a really good question, and you're exactly right. There is a lot of material, you know, that you can get per acre from a hemp crop. The challenge is that right now hemp is an annual, and one of the key things that we look at is kind of an overall accounting, what we could call a life cycle assessment. So how much energy do we need to be put in versus the amount that we get out? And with an annual crop, we're stuck in a situation that is pretty innate to being much more intensive in terms of energy input. You just have to replant every year. There's more requirements for fertilizer, and that really puts us more on par with, for example, our annual crops like corn. And we're really kind of trying to look to, you know, to be able to get away from that, to take advantage of a more of a perennial perennial type of system that also provides a lot of benefits more broadly in terms of what we call ecosystem services, things such as increased biodiversity. You know, that said, you know, the same is true. Another crop that's kind of in this category is sorghum, sweet sorghum. And if, you know, and there is research looking at, you know, asking the fundamental question, can we take some of these annual crops that have high yields and benefits and could we potentially perennialize them? And I think that's the kind of thing that could be a real game changer for something like hemp or sorghum as well. But I think we're still, you know, and Phil, you may have some more information on this, but I think we're still a fair ways away from having those types of properties in a crop like hemp.
Become annual. Okay. Comment, Phil?
Yeah, I think that is a huge distinction between different kinds of potential crops is annual versus perennial. And the extent to which we can identify crops that have these what we call sustainability attributes, these properties that lend themselves to environmental and environmental benefits as well as energy benefits are really what we're all about. And, you know, we're in the business of really trying to understand the fundamentals of these systems and the properties that really matter. And then once these are identified, and we're pretty close, we've mm-hmm. identified quite a number already, then we can think about moving them out into a wider diversity of crops that might include things like hemp and energy sorghum. But we can also think about the current perennial crops, the perennial plants we now have, and think about ways to deploy them.
Which ones are showing the most promise in your mind?
So the ones that seem to provide, well, first of all, a lot of perennial grasses and trees, purpose-grown trees, trees that can be harvested on a short rotation cycle like poplar or willow, show quite a lot of promise for providing both the energy as well as a lot of the environmental benefits. One of the interesting benefits that we've been able to document is the biodiversity benefits, the conservation mm-hmm. benefits of many of these grass species in particular, and the ability to put out, to think about growing on marginal lands, the grasses such as switchgrass, which is a native perennial grass from North America. It was one of the four major prairie grasses, is still, I guess. We just don't have very much prairie. Gives conservation benefits in terms of birds and insects and all the other organisms that once inhabited a prairie that you just don't get with more exotic species, such as miscanthus, which you sometimes hear touted as a bioenergy crop. And so in my mind and others, when we can think about integrating all of the potential benefits of these, not just energy, not just nitrogen conservation, but also conservation benefits, then we can really start thinking about how to improve the ecosystems that are now perhaps 50% exotic or oftentimes even on degraded abandoned farmland to bring it back into a more productive and sustainable part of the landscape.
Yeah, it's a great way to look at it, isn't it, John?
Yeah, you know, and actually, just to take that concept of how you look at it, the other thing that's interesting is I think most people don't realize when you look at a prairie, it doesn't look like very much. It's like, well, there's not a lot growing there compared to a forest, so to speak, for example. But really, in many ways, a prairie, you can think of a prairie as kind of being an inverted forest. There is so much going on below ground.
Below the
ground. Prairie grasses and forbs have just tremendous root systems, which provide benefits that aren't immediately obvious. I mean, a big one in terms of our topic of climate change is we're sequestering carbon. We're taking carbon out of the atmosphere through photosynthesis and burying it underground. And as long as we maintain that system properly, you know, we're really providing a significant benefit. But we're also at the same time we're building soil. I mean, this is how our wonderful Midwest soils, you know, where they came from in the first place is through these, you know, deep rooted systems. Mm-hmm. And over time, some root dies and microbes take over, and we build a very stable, dynamic, durable carbon, you know, high carbon soil that really does provide, you know, everything that we think of in terms of our breadbasket.
So, and then those grasses are coming up year after year. And
exactly.
So you think about fuel saved, as an example.
Absolutely.
Compared to corn, for example.
You're planting once and you know, looking at harvests for, you know, 10 years more, we're still really getting a good handle in terms of what the longevity, I think, of some of these crops might be. But, yeah, not having to replant, potentially replow, et cetera, reestablish year after year an annual crop is very significant.
And that's the basis for the very high energy return on investment, as it's called. That is to say, the very high climate benefit of the cellulosic bioenergy crops as opposed to, say, grain-based crops where that currently require annual cultivation and fertilization and planting and so on. But you have on the order of a 20% climate benefit from grain-based ethanol, but, you know, somewhere on the order of 700 to 1,500 percent benefit as for the cellulosic crops.
Yeah. Talking again, just to remind you, John Greenler and Philip Robertson are guests today as we visit with them about climate change and crops and what agriculture is doing, kind of in its share of creating the issues or the problems and what it's doing to mitigate them. And really this research is designed at mitigating. And you were saying that we could get a zero based effect on this, that actually agriculture could maybe help the climate in the end.
Well, yeah. So we know from research here and elsewhere now across the globe that now that we know what the sources of greenhouse gases are in cropping systems, we can think about strategies, farming techniques to address each one of those in turn or all of them together from a systems approach. And in annual cropping systems, corn, soybean, for example, we know that we can reduce the current greenhouse gas cost of conventional farming to zero by implementing no-till, for example, because no-till effectively stores carbon, not quite as well as perennial crops, but pretty close, and that effectively offsets the nitrogen fertilizer use, the greenhouse gases from nitrogen fertilizer use in those annual crops. And then, of course, in perennial crops, in the biofuel crops, we can easily drive that to negative. We can also, in addition to no-till, we can also think about better ways to use nitrogen in annual crops, as well as cover crops to help store even additional carbon. And that drives the system to net negative. That is, it takes an agricultural field, a typical field that you might see driving into work, to one that is pulling CO2 out of the air and effectively storing that and reducing the emission of other greenhouse gases, so that there's a net benefit, even in the absence of converting the product to biofuels. But then, of course, once you do convert some of the product to biofuels, you get an even bigger bang for the buck. So it's there are opportunities out there. We know the technology, we know the science, and right now we are largely awaiting the policies and other instruments that are going to enable farmers to think about doing this in real time.
And I was just thinking about technologies as you were talking there, and as it relates to corn and beans. I know guys who have systems, farm systems, where the machinery is able to actually determine foot by foot or yard by yard in a field the fertilizer needs, mm-hmm. for example. So 1 yard might be different from 2 yards away.
Well, that's right. And that technology, which farmers call variable rate farming, which means you apply different rates of fertilizer to different parts of the field depending on the potential yield of that part of the field, can lead to pretty substantial decreases in the amount of nitrogen fertilizer that is applied without affecting yield, or in some cases even increasing yield, because you're putting a little more fertilizer on those parts of the field that are most productive, and of course less fertilizer on those parts of the field that are less productive, instead of putting the same rate across the entire field where part of it's not enough and part of it just is wasted.
Yeah, it's too much.
Yeah. Both, yeah, you know, where that nitrogen goes and when it goes is also really important as well. So making sure that you get that nitrogen into the plant when it's really primed to, you know, going through rapid growth to be able to take advantage of that fertilizer is really critical.
Yeah, that fertilizer is responsible for about, in a conventional farm field, is responsible for about 75% of the greenhouse gas footprint. So that is probably the single most important place to target when reducing the greenhouse gas footprint of a farm field.
I was at a party not long ago, and someone asked me, I don't know how we got onto this, but it was somebody asked, well, no-till, doesn't that mean you're not going to get as good of production out of your crop? And I had no research in the back of my head to answer.
Well, the answer, the quick answer is no. It doesn't mean a yield hit in most situations. Now, there are specific times when that might happen, but in general, the long-term research that's been done shows that not only do you not negatively affect yields, you often get an 8 to 10% increase in yield. And that's because with no-till, you're building soil carbon, and soil carbon is the same thing as soil organic matter, and every gardener knows the importance of having soil organic matter to provide good tilth, what soil physicists used to call good soil structure for plants. And that tilth is really important for holding on to soil moisture. So that, you know, a good example of that is in the 2012 drought. The fields that seemed to withstand the drought best were those that were no-till, because they had more water stored in the soil at the beginning of the drought than did the conventionally farmed fields. And so one other way to think about this is that no-till doesn't have much effect on yields in most years, but when the crop is really stressed, it can pay off in those stressful years.
Yeah. Well, I sort of said that.
It's also interesting in terms of the effect of tillage on the soil microbes. And this is an area that there's just so much to learn. It's actually, I think, quite exciting. But we do recognize that we really alter the microbial ecology, the populations of different microorganisms, of which there are, you know, thousands more, you know, of species, you know, in any field. And, you know, the fungi especially, which have these long kind of strands, we're literally shredding those fungi and really diminishing their functionality. And I think we recognize broadly that they provide a lot of important, very hidden but important services. And by, you know, degrading, you know, those the vitality of those that fungi, it's clear that we're taking a loss there as well.
Well, let's take some more calls. Jim in Madison, you're up next. Thanks for calling, Jim.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call. A question that I hope your guests can answer. A standard barrel of oil contains 42 gallons of oil. It's a production of photosynthesis hundreds of millions of years ago. If you express it in terms of 1 acre, how many years of photosynthesis would it you need on 1 acre to produce the energy contained in a barrel of oil?
Wow.
You know, I don't have that number off the top of my head, but I do have another interesting number, and that is that for every year of fossil fuel use and that we're using globally right now, it's taken about 1 million years of photosynthesis to produce that. And so the oil that's underground for every year of current use that we might have, you can imagine that X millions of years were required to produce the plant material that eventually became that oil.
And I can add another way of looking at that. I apologize, I can't answer it directly, but there have been some interesting studies saying, well, if we were able to fully scale up this cellulosic fuel, sustainable fuel technology, we'd be looking, I think it's around 1.3 billion tons of biomass that we could be harvesting per year in the United States alone. Mm-hmm. So that's just looking here in the U.S. And that would probably, you know, yield enough fuel for us to reduce our our fossil fuel input into transportation by about 30%. So, when you add it all up at the end of the day, it's a very big number. You know, and as Phil was saying earlier, it's not going to completely solve our transportation energy conundrum, but 30% is really significant, especially when you add it up along with increased efficiency of vehicles and the opportunity that we have in terms of electric vehicles, cars specifically. So put it all together, I think, it can be a part of the solution, so to speak.
Jim, thanks a lot. I want to give Robert a chance to join us from Duluth, Minnesota next. Robert, hi.
Hi, and thank you for your program. It's fantabulous. I got a comment, and that is, I've got 80 acres of alder. In other words, it's just plain old Minnesota brush.
Yep.
And will this, question one, will this make an alternative fuel? Can it be used, or is it just garbage? The second one is, going back to your grass, I'm retired, and I would give half of my retired wages if you and other University of Wisconsin and the one over here in southern Minnesota, an agriculture research station, I can't think of the name, but anyway, doing a wonderful job. And can those stations be spread out and more tax money taken? Let's talk to our governor.
Well, all right. Well, let's start. I don't know if we can answer the second part, but what about that first part with alder as a feasible wood, or maybe wood in general? But let's address alder.
Yeah, I can take a stab at that. So the beauty of the cellulosic biofuel enterprise is that all plants produce cellulose and hemicellulose and lignins, which is what's used as the basic building blocks within a biorefinery, or the basic feedstocks. And so it's possible to use virtually any kind of vegetative material. Now, that's not to say one would want to use any kind of vegetative material, because the climate benefit will depend on what you're using. So that if you have an intact forest, for example, if you take that and turn that into biofuel, there will be very little net climate benefit, because you're taking 100 years of carbon accumulation and putting it into the atmosphere right away, and it will take 100 years for that forest to regrow. And so for 100 years, there won't be much of a climate benefit from using that wood. But on the other hand, if you're using purpose-grown wood, such as an alder or a poplar or a willow, that might be harvested every 10 years or so because they're very fast growing, that in addition to whatever herbaceous or grassy materials you might also harvest, perhaps from somewhere else, that material does have a very positive climate benefit because of the time frame in which the carbon is accumulated. So my answer to Jim is that, yes, it should be possible to use that alder so long as you want, so long as it's been grown fairly recently. And I won't necessarily take a stab at the second question because I'm not sure I fully understand it, but
we'll let it go at that because okay. We're out of time.
Okay.
Oh, Phil, it's been great. And John, it's been great talking with you both. I hope John, I know you'll come back. Phil, I hope you'll come back.
I'd love to.
Oh, it's great. Thank you so much. Phil Robertson, the sustainability lead with the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, directs long-term ecological research at the Kellogg Biological Station, of course, working hand in glove with the University of Wisconsin. John Greenler, associated with the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, directs education at the Wisconsin Energy Institute at UW-Madison. They'll be back. We'll do it again with them. Coming up, we're going to take a look at how today's moms can re-enter the workplace successfully. There's a great new book out on that. That's next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.